For the week of January 6th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 434, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Rockefeller Center in New York City, wearing a blindfold, I'm Michael Giltz.
You can't make that joke. I'm wearing a blindfold. I'm doing the Bird Box challenge, and I'm doing the entire podcast with a blindfold on.
Wait, people got to understand, we don't always tell each other what we're going to spring on one another when the show. We're like Siskel and Ebert. We don't talk except when we do the show. So when you think, like, we don't have this planned out always. So it's like, clearly we both wanted to make this dumb joke. Netflix had to release a statement to people after Bird Box, the Sandra Bullock thriller, became such a hit. They're like, don't walk around outside with a blindfold on. Don't hurt yourself, you idiots. There's a restaurant in Brooklyn serving meals where you eat them blindfolded. I mean, it's like, this is out of, it's gone from nobody's heard of it to massive phenomenon to, you know, parodied in about 4.2 seconds. I'm surprised Andy Samberg and Sandra Oh weren't wearing blindfolds when they hosted the Golden Globes.
Yeah, well, you know, don't get me started on their hosting job, but
All right. Well, I will say one follow-up. That was for Bird Box. Another one is Mariah Carey. As soon as we went to press, her song went even higher for that one last Christmas to New Year's week. Her song, All I Want for Christmas Is You, hit a new peak of number 3 on the Billboard charts in North America. She hit number 1 in Australia. Even Elvis got back into the top 40 in the U.S. with Blue Christmas. So Christmas music dominating the charts, and Mariah Carey, after years and years of becoming an enduring standard, her pop song, it's not a standard, great record, I should say. It's the biggest Christmas hit in 60 years.
Well, just going back to Bird Box for a second, do you think if that movie had been released in theaters, it would be as big a hit and as much of a phenomenon as it is, having been on Netflix?
No telling. I don't think there's any, you know, you can't say, well, if we had taken this TV, Brian's song, the TV movie, and put it in theaters, it would have become a heartwarming classic that made men cry. Who knows? You know, there's no telling. Every time there's a movie, you say, well, they shouldn't have done a wide release. They should have just started with limited. Or they do a limited release. And, no, you should have done a wide release. You know, it's gamble. Every movie's differently. It worked for that project. I don't think it provides a formula of success, nor would I say, oh, if it opened up in theaters, it would have been so much bigger. It's like, you never know. And that's what Netflix wants to say. Hey, there's a lot of different ways to create content and get it out to the world. Stop yelling at us. We don't own theater chains. It's not our fault. Forgive us for making something people want to watch. Leave us alone, but watch Netflix.
So there, Carol Burnett, take that.
Yeah. Leave her alone. So people are talking about Bird Box, but what are we going to be talking about on this week's podcast?
Well, we already talked about Bird Box. So this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're getting into the swim of things. Swim of things? Did you really mean that?
Have you never heard that expression?
Never heard it, no.
Oh, it's just we're getting into the groove.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a new year, and we're delivering two podcasts in a row. That's right. Last week and this week. So you're welcome.
And thank you, as always, for listening. You know, let's say that to everybody else. You know, if we didn't mention at the end of last year, thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for telling your friends. And hey, it's a new year. Why not start it right by rating and reviewing the show? Head to iTunes. Don't be that person who listens for free and never helps the one little bit way they can. It's a new year, new resolution. 5 stars, a quick comment. I love it. I listen every week. That's all we need, and it really would help.
Now, the news never stops, and neither do we. We're starting to get some solid numbers on 2018 box office totals around the world, and we'll fill you in on the good news. Awards season continues, and we've got winners from the National Film Critics, the Golden Globes, and nominations from groups that matter more than any of those combined, including editors, art directors, writers, and producers. In the Middle Kingdom, a very avant-garde art house film was turned into a New Year's Eve smash hit, and ticket buyers are furious. Our discussion will be a long day's journey into deceptive marketing practices. In sexual misconduct news, TV personality Neil deGrasse Tyson saw his talk show, Star Chat, put on hold Women are still deeply underrepresented on film sets, and Kim Masters of The Hollywood Reporter raises some compelling issues about an investigation into the Showtime comedy, Smilf. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a look back at Michael's theater picks when he told us which upcoming shows he would invest in. I'm now broke. Thanks a lot, Michael. We'll find out how he did. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
You know, sometimes I ego listen. Just really to check the show and see what my delivery is like and what's going on. And I always feel a little jealous because your audio is always better than mine because you're the home base and I'm across the country and we do it via Skype. And I just feel like, oh, you know, I get a good mic. I do everything I can. It's that you still have more dulcet tones because you're there editing it. But I think this week I'm going to come out on top because you've still got that little echoey bathroom sound effect that I heard when we were setting up the show.
Yeah,
but
you
anyway.
Know, I think it's because I'm, you know, ever since they renovations of the studio started, they never finished, and I've been kind of in a closet, so to speak.
I suddenly thought maybe the loan people have come and taken away your furniture piece by piece and the carpeting's gone and now you're down to an empty room, just a microphone and a laptop doing the show.
Nope.
Okay. Well, we get our information from ComScore, and we are talking about box office around the world. We also add in information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Holly Reporter. You are listeners. You help a lot. And the number one movie around the world is Bumblebee. $95 million on the weekend. Thank you, China. Bumblebee opened to $60 million in that country. Sure, it's down from what the other Transformers movies did in China, but it's triple what Bumblebee opened up at in North America. It opened up in the U.S. with $21 million. In China, it tripled that and opened with $60 million, and audiences loved it and are talking it up, so it could have some very good legs. So it's at $95 million on the weekend. $290 million worldwide. So I think it's safe to say, with Japan coming in March, that Bumblebee will triple its reported budget and get to about $400 million at least. So maybe they'll go for a Bumblebee too.
Well, you know, and everybody I have heard who's seen it, they like it.
Oh, there you go. And number two around the world is Aquaman. This is a DC film. Like Wonder Woman, it has really gotten pretty good reviews and great box office. And in fact, keep in mind, pretty much all the DC Universe movies from the last few years have made money. They've done really, really well commercially. They haven't all been well reviewed, but they've all been very profitable. That can't continue forever, but hey, it's working. And so people say, this is the biggest DC film since this or that. Forget all that. This movie made $86 million on the weekend. It's at $940 million worldwide. It's going to pass the $1 billion mark. It's going to pass probably The Dark Knight Returns. And forget DC. This will be one of Warner Brothers' biggest hits of all time. It's one of the 40 biggest films of all time. Even when you adjust for inflation, this is a big, big hit. At number three around the world is Mary Poppins Returns. $38 million on the weekend, $260 million worldwide. Going back to the original, I did what Sperling always loves to do, adjust for inflation. The original film came out in North America in 1964. I have no idea what it grossed in the rest of the world, but in the North American market alone, it grossed $100 million. That's equal to $800 million in 2017. That's a lot of money. So this movie, it's doing okay. It's going to be all right. It's showing good legs. This too, like Bumblebee, is going to come out decently despite a kind of a rough start. So Disney can breathe a sigh of relief, even if though they probably won't rush to make another Mary Poppins films. All the other elements are in place, so maybe they will. At number four is Ralph Breaks the Internet, $30 million on the weekend, $400 million worldwide. At number five is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, a new Golden Globe winner, well-deserved, I should say, $25 million on the weekend, $275 million worldwide. And this might be one of those films that really gets a boost from all the awards attention. People who are saying, you know what? They're going to make more of an effort to check this movie out because there's a lot of room to grow in the U.S. and around the world. And number six is Bohemian Rhapsody, another big winner at the Globes. $19 million on the weekend, $740 million worldwide. That is a phenomenon. And number 7 is Kill Mobile, that Chinese remake of the Italian cell phone comedy. $12 million on the weekend, $74 million worldwide. Basically, it's in Korea and two other territories. I'm sorry, China and what would that be? China and Hong Kong is a separate market, right?
No, usually they open up around the same time. It is a separate market, but yes, they tend to.
So it's in three territories. And so I'm assuming it's China, Hong Kong, and one other region right near there. But that's tearing it up. $74 million worldwide. Someday we'll get a chart showing which one of them made the most money worldwide or which one did the best in their country given that market, you know, how much of a big hit it was. Italy, China, it goes on and on and on. And number 8, Dr. Seuss's The Grinch. That's just about to hit $500 million worldwide. At number 9, Clint Eastwood movie. This is the time of year where movies show a lot of legs. They might start modestly, but they just go and go and go. That's what Mary Poppins Returns hopes for. That's certainly what we're seeing with The Mule. That made $9 million on the weekend. That's at $81 million in North America. It's still got the rest of the world to go, so this movie is going to be just fine. It's one of Clint's biggest hits in the last few years. Only Gran Torino, as far as a film he's been in, looms larger. He also had American Sniper, didn't he?
He did have American Sniper, yeah, but keep in mind
that was a big hit.
That was a big hit, Bradley Cooper. Keep in mind, this is a film that is, you know, it stars a 90-year-old guy. Okay,
he's not 90, is he?
I don't know. I think he's like in his 80s, right?
Yes, he's certainly in his 80s, but you know, got to be accurate. My mom turns 90 in a few weeks.
He's 88 years old,
right?
And so
my mom is older,
right? So what I'm saying is that I think that he. I think the demographic for this movie doesn't necessarily race out on opening day. They're going to see this movie, you know, for weeks to come.
Well, any adult drama is like that. It doesn't matter if the star is 20 or 70. But yes, that's true. It's an older audience that it appeals to. The young people will be brought in by perhaps the action elements and Bradley Cooper. But yeah, it's an adult film. It can have long legs. Green Book has done well. The Mule is doing great. And number 10 is a Russian film. It's called T-34. It's a Russian war movie set during World War II. It's about Russian prisoners of war who use a broken down tank to escape a German camp. It opened to $8.5 million. I had no idea what a T-34 is, so I looked it up. It was a Soviet tank that came out during World War II, and it was vastly superior to all the other tanks that were out there. Had better armor, had better range, had better ammo, everything about it was faster. It really just, you know, upended everything, and other tanks came after it, but it really was the scene setter for the tank in World War II. Kind of cool. And number 11 is The Favorite, $8 million on the weekend, $26 million worldwide, lots of room to grow thanks to all the awards attention. And number 12 is Vice, a movie that really needs that awards attention because it was pretty pricey. It cost $60 million to make. It's at $32 million, but it's only in 4 markets. It is an American dark political comedy that probably won't travel well, but it helps to have all those big stars.
And the best part was when Christian Bale accepted the award for Best Actor for it, and he came up there with that you know, British accent, that almost Cockney British accent.
Well, he's Welsh, but yes, he's it's always charming. Well, you know, when you're picking Golden Globe nominees and who you think will win, if you've got a category where there's 4 Americans and one person from another country, it's always a good bet to go with the person from another country. They are an international body, and they tend to love to celebrate that. That happened big time last night with the guy from Bodyguard winning Best Actor in a Drama. That was wildly unexpected. And, of course, some of the other movies that triumphed, like Bohemian Rhapsody.
We'll talk about that in a bit.
At number 14 is Creed 2, $150 million worldwide. At number 15 is Second Act, the J-Lo, not comedy, romance, I guess, Office Place. No, I guess it is sort of a comedy romance. I don't know. Whatever it is, it made $6 million on the weekend. It's at $42 million worldwide. At number 16, How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. This is the third and final film in an animation trilogy. They've all been quite well reviewed. They're getting a little less expensive with each movie, which is a little unusual. This one costs $130 million, just down a tick from the first two. And they're grossing more, so we'll have to see how this one does. It's just opened up in 2 territories, but you should expect at least $500 million from this movie. And it's starting off quite quietly with $5.3 million. It's got a big, promising future ahead of it because all the reviews were just glowing. That certainly wasn't the case for Holmes and Watson, that travesty, that insult to Sherlock. $5.1 million on the weekend, $35 million worldwide and counting. Mortal Engines keeps making a little bit of money. It's in 62 territories, and it's just about to hit $70 million. That is a big disappointment for a movie they hoped would be a franchise. And number 19 is Polizeisky S. Rubelyovki.
So basically, it's a Russian show that you can't pronounce.
It's a Russian
yeah.
It's a TV show spun off into a movie. Polizeisky S. Rubelyovki. It's about a police station. I think it's sort of in the middle of nowhere. It's had a couple series, seasons of the TV show. It's not Police Academy as far as I can tell, but it's broad and dumb. And basically they're about to be shut down because people think it's not needed and it's Christmas time. So some of the cops or whatever get the idea they should rob a bank so that then they can save the day. So the trailer features them running around in Santa and elf and reindeer costumes. Hijinks ensue. That's all I can guess. $4.5 million on the weekend. I guess it opened in the middle of the week. That's at $9.4 million and counting. Asterix, the new edition of Asterix and Obelix, a new animated French film. That's chugging along. That's at $32 million. Right below that is a German comic drama I got a little bit more information about. This is The Kid Needs Air, Needs Country Air. Kids got to go to the country. We weren't quite sure what it's about. Now we know. It's made $13 million in two markets, mostly Germany. And it's based on the childhood memoir of a famed, beloved TV and radio comic named Hop Kirkling. Hope I'm saying his name right. He's done all sorts of TV and sketch shows since breaking out at a young age. He came out as gay in 1991, because that was one question I had about looking at the trailer. And apparently, in one very famous episode of a sketch show that he does, he dressed up as Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands and then tried to slip into the Schloss Bellevue, a government building, for a meeting with the president of Germany. The queen was in town and on a state visit, and he just showed up dressed as her and said, "I'm here to have lunch with the prime minister, the president." And he almost got in. So that created quite a stir at the time. He is beloved, I assume. So everybody knows this guy. Everybody knows his story. And this is a story from his childhood where his mom, I think, committed suicide. So there's a lot of tear jerking and sadness.
Wow, that kind of went south fast.
Yeah. So started painful. Well, a lot of comics have a little pain in their lives, of course. And that was obviously a difficult moment. He went off to the country to live with his grandparents and wowed everybody with his comic flair. Well, I'm glad to be able to explain what that movie is. And sometimes we're at a bit of a loss. Looking down at number 23 is another new film. It's Mia and the White Lion, a French drama, heartwarming, I assume, about a teenager from London whose family moves to Africa, where she, of course, befriends a lion cub.
That then grows up into a lion and eats her.
Right. Siegfried and Roy. That's all we want to say. It's not a pet. So $8.4 million so far in seven territories. And right at the bottom is another Russian film. It's the sixth in a series. It's the most successful live-action franchise in Russian history. It's called Yolki Posledin, and it means kind of New Year's Tree. And it says New Year's Tree Final, meaning, all right, this is the last film in the series. That's what they're promising. It made about $3 million on its opening weekend. If that's good enough to keep it going, I'm sure they'll change their mind.
Now this is the way to pronounce the previous Russian film that you...
Polizeisky s Rublevki. Polizeisky s Rublevki.
Something I wouldn't understand.
Right. Well, but you do understand all of these box office figures, and specifically you understand what it's like when you go see a film and you just loved the trailer. I mean, you thought this movie's gonna be great. And you walk in and you think, I can't wait for this action movie. And then it's a movie about, it's a sad, weepy romance movie.
Well, that almost never happens. It doesn't pay to trick people into going to see your movie. It rarely, rarely happens unless you've got an incredibly obscure art film that is never going to have a commercial audience. And that's what one company had with Long Day's Journey Into Night, a film that played at Cannes and got some real enthusiasm by some people, especially for a 51-minute tracking shot, I think, where our hero is wandering down the street late at night. This is not a movie for the multiplexes. However, they took this movie and really did mislead people with an ad campaign. They built it as the perfect romantic film to start off the New Year's, and it worked like gangbusters. People just signed up to see this movie. It opened to how much money? Like $28 million or something, or 40, or it made so much money on New Year's Eve. It was astonishing, and people were furious. They were like literally ready to riot and storm the box office. And in fact, though the movie made like $30 million over that opening night, the next day, of course, ticket sales dropped completely, and the company's stock fell as well over the uproar. It lost $280 million in one day. So they made $30 million.
It lost $280 million? Oh, you mean the company's
stock. Okay, yeah. So they made $30 million on a movie that never would have made a dime, and yet they maybe lost $280 million. So they're down, I'm not really good with math, but $250 million?
Yeah.
Maybe it'll bounce back up, but it was an amazing trick, and it's hard to believe they pulled it off because in this day and age, it had already been reviewed at Cannes. It wasn't like
but the word in English, wasn't out. It just goes to show you that it was reviewed in English.
I'm sure Chinese people, it's an Asian film. I'm sure it was reviewed in Cantonese and Chinese. Of course it was. They have journalists there.
Yeah.
It's not just English speaking people. Movies are reviewed at Cannes in Spanish, French, German, Russian, Mandarin, you know, every language under the sun. So it was reviewed. They could have read it. I'm surprised that word did not get out more quickly. People go, hey, don't fall for this. That's ridiculous.
You know, I saw the first hour of this movie in Cannes, and I had fortune or misfortune, depending on what you call it. I rarely walk out of a film, but at a film festival, you've got so many films to see, and there's often conflicts. So if you are missing something else and you're sitting through a movie like Long Day's Journey and you're thinking, what is this movie about? It's basically about a guy who's trying to figure out, is he awake or not awake? What's real? What's not real?
I do that every day.
Well, if you're like jet lagged and exhausted from, you know, a film festival, that's probably not a good movie to see when you have to read subtitles. And so I left. I walked out. And then like an hour and a half later, everybody from IndieWire comes back and says, oh my God, that movie. Yeah, okay, it wasn't great, but the, 50
the
minutes
tracking
in,
shot.
The tracking shot. It was like the best tracking shot ever, the best single take ever. And I thought, great. So I left right before the one thing you'd actually want to see.
If you were a movie nerd, but it's certainly not something that would excite audiences, even though they've seen big tracking shots in movies like Atonement and Goodfellas. But yeah, that's just for film geeks, obviously.
Right. Well, of course, the tracking shot to end all tracking shots was there's one in Gravity, but there's also one, Birdman was one long tracking shot.
Well, not the whole film, was it?
Yeah, the whole film was supposedly one long track. Now, mind you, it was, of course, spliced together. They just don't tell you where it was spliced together. And Russian Ark is...
Russian Ark, of course, was the one I was going to mention. That really is one long tracking shot. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, there you go. Who cares about that stuff? Not us. But how's the Chinese box office doing? That movie certainly helped goose the New Year's Eve budget. What's happening with the rest of China?
Well, okay, so $8.9 billion last year, grew 9%. It gained a little bit of ground on the U.S., as we talked about last week. They added 9,000 screens to hit 60,000 screens. So they have more screens than anybody else, any other country in the world. Hong Kong grew by 6%. And the two Korean films, I guess, are in the top 10. Is that correct?
I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and the Hong Kong box office, just under $2 billion U.S. That's actually saying something because it's not a very big place. Not included in this is the Chinese figures. Are they broken out from Hong Kong? I'm going to have to check on that.
Yes, I'm not sure if when they report overall China box office, if that includes Hong Kong or whether it's still separate. I know South Korea is separate, at least for the moment, from North Korea. Their revenue was up 3% to $1.6 billion. So up modestly, but still growing, probably barely keeping pace with inflation or audience growth. But attendance was down or kind of really flat from 220 million to 216 million admissions sold. But guess what? South Korea has 51 million people. So that's one of the highest per capita ticket sales in the world. The U.S. doesn't do that much. You know, four tickets sold for every person in the country. That'd be 1.2 billion tickets. Is that close to what we are? $8 a ticket? Actually, it is, isn't it? Wow. Four tickets sold for every person in South Korea, and U.S. is right up there with them. That is where those are two movie crazy companies. And you know, if you think we're still talking about last year, guess what? People are already ringing the bell about this year. It took 1 week, and Variety said, uh-oh, North American box office has fallen behind last year. They said, quote, January is a traditionally slow month at the box office. Even so, 2019 is already pacing 16.5% behind the same weekend last year when Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, held the domestic crown. Thankfully, they did add, there's no need for doom and gloom just yet. Let's wait till week three for that.
Now, I'm looking here and I do see box office numbers separate for Hong Kong than China on several different titles.
So, well, I know they're available. So that means the whole overall market. So, wow, if you toss in China, that's, it's a separate place right now. But that will grow the Chinese box office quite a bit if they just decide to subsume that. That would make them a $11 million market, right? $11 billion market. That's just a smidge behind North America.
So that actually tells you it is, you know, those two, Hong Kong and China, are not combined.
Right, because no, it doesn't, because it could be $9 billion, and if you took out Hong Kong, it would be $7 billion.
True.
So it doesn't tell us anything. But if that is separate, adding that in means China already is damn close to North America. And Taiwan is saying, but don't count our dollars, because we are really not part of China.
Yeah, please. There's no reunification here.
And we just got banned in China.
Correct. But not in Taiwan. We're going to be huge in Taiwan.
That's right. It's award season, and we love the Chinese people, just not necessarily your government, just like we feel about our own. It's award season, and people are voting, and not just on president and prime minister. They're also voting for their favorite films of the year. The National Society of Film Critics weighed in, and so did the Golden Globes. Neither of them matter. But the National Society of Film Critics said The Rider is the best film of the year, and I certainly loved that movie. Roma won Best Director, Best Cinematography, and Foreign Films. That's probably their favorite. And Ethan Hawke and Olivia Colman topped the acting awards. The usual suspects are on the running, but remember, the National Society of Film Critics are not a guild. Neither are the Golden Globe voters. They are not part of any guild that contributes to the Oscars. The same is true for the Golden Globes. They do not include any guild members. But of course, they can get movies' attention. Bohemian Rhapsody and Green Book were the big winners last night, taking Best Drama and Best Comedy, or Best Comedy and Best Drama. I'm not sure which one which. They could switch categories and no one would blink an eye. And in TV, the big winners were The Americans and the Netflix comedy The Kominsky Method, starring Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin. Owen Gleiberman of Hollywood Reporter put it best. He calls the Globes a dress rehearsal for the Oscars. And when there's a surprise Golden Globe winner, it's kind of like a rehearsal where sometimes the understudy goes on and steals the show. So what matters is not who won, but if you won and got to go on stage, did you give a good speech? I would say yes for Christian Bale, Olivia Colman, and Glenn Close. So that's helpful to all those actors when they show graciousness, happiness, and give an entertaining or heartwarming or heart-tugging speech. That's always good. Was there a speech you thought really helped somebody?
I thought Christian Bale did a very good job.
It was sort of a list speech, but he made it feel personal and fun. It wasn't, I want to thank my agent. No, I want to thank my, you know, he made it feel actually personal and passionate when he thanked those people.
Yeah. Glenn Close, I don't think she thought she was going to win at all. I mean, she had nothing, but she pulled it out. I thought that was like, wow. Okay. She didn't think she was going to win. She got up on stage and she did a really good job.
She didn't think she'd win. You don't know actors, A, and B, that's called acting. Pretending you didn't expect to win is the supreme job of an actor. No, but you always think you'll win. Of course you'll win. Who was better? No one. But yes, people thought Lady Gaga would win. It was Glenn Close. She gave a great speech. And now people are like, ooh, it's going to be a tight one between Olivia Colman, Lady Gaga, and maybe Glenn Close. Will she take votes away from Olivia Colman or Lady Gaga? Who will that help? Well, you know, the thing about the Globes is it's the fun show. It's the show that puts on a good show. And you know what? I watched about half of it and I was sort of entertained. You know, I was skipping through the commercials and stuff. But I thought, you know what? How hard is it to get good hosts? I thought they were fine, Sandra Oh and Andy Samberg.
Did you see their opening monologue?
Yeah. The joke where they pretended to roast people and they were just paying compliments. Whatever. It was fine. It was over quickly. Who cares? I thought it was funny when they said, let's look back on great moments of the Globes and just showed themselves winning two awards and stopped.
That was very funny. That was very funny because they said, look, we said that these were moments that moved us, not you guys, us. I thought that was very funny.
So the Globes need a lot of, you know, they should get some pats on the back for putting on a pretty entertaining show, especially if you didn't watch all 3 hours and 20 minutes of it live. They still screw up some things. Why the hell do they have Best Drama on right at the beginning of the night, you know, before the TV acting nods? I would think you'd end with Best Comedy, Best Drama, Best Comedy Film, and Best Drama Film, you know, TV and film right together. But TV is a bastard stepchild there, even though they have more influence perhaps on the Emmys than they do on the Oscars. But I don't know about you. I thought they did a great job with Steve Carell's tribute to Carol Burnett, the clipped shows that they did, setting her up as important, and then her speech was just, I thought, just marvelous.
Wonderful. I thought she did a great job of explaining the industry to people outside of it by saying, look, you know, my show would never be done today because there's just no place to do it. That said, I think it would probably be done on Netflix.
Well, Lorne Michaels was in the audience going, well, we've got a variety show. Maybe you've heard of it. But Netflix was certainly a huge winner. But hey, it's the Globes, so that does not mean the same as winning an Oscar or an Emmy. Nonetheless, Alfonso Cuarón came out swinging backstage when someone said, I think it was from Deadline or I forget. But they said, hey, does this, the success of Roma mean the death of indie cinema and especially the chains that support them? He said, how dare you? He said, basically, how many screens do you think a black and white film in Spanish and Mixteco and featuring no stars is going to play on? It's been playing in theaters for 6 weeks. How many foreign films get released in 70 millimeter today? Come on. Leave us alone. Just give us an Oscar.
Yeah, it'll be, you know, I think Oscar-wise, I think that the industry wants to, they're going to want to knight Lady Gaga as a newcomer. You know, kind of like give her the award and say, you know.
Olivia Colman was very funny, though.
She was very funny. But I think at the end of the day, they're going to want somebody like a Lady Gaga up on stage. That's just.
Yeah, I don't think people really vote for like that. I know that's how people always try to think about it and strategize and explain who they think might win. I think she's a perfectly, any one of them could win. I would assume it's between Colman and Gaga. I don't care that the Globes voted for Glenn Close. Most people haven't seen the movie. Most people won't see the movie. And that includes Oscar voters. They're not all going to put in the wife and watch it. It's an older appealing movie, her and Jonathan Pryce, but it made no spread at the box office. It didn't get a ton of attention. She's been on a lot of awards lists, but that's for critics and stuff. And I just don't think that she's really a contender for the Oscars just because 90 critics of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association weighed in. I think it's between Colman and Gaga. And yeah, Gaga could win. So could Colman. And I don't think they'll say, I want to see Gaga on stage. You know, I just, unless there's some, I think the best example of that would be Tom Hanks, his speech at the Globes when he won for Philadelphia. And it was just so lovable. I was, oh my God, he's giving a tribute to his gay high school, you know, acting teacher, and that they just wanted to see that on the Oscars and said, oh my God, what a great speech. And, you know, he was already, you know, probably a front runner anyway, but that sort of put it, locked it into place. Yeah. I don't know. But what I know is that what matters is not who wins at the Globes and all these critics awards. What matters is what the guilds vote on. And that's where the information is coming, pouring in.
Well, because there's a lot of overlap. So if you're an editor, in the ACE, you know, American Cinema Editors Guild, you might also be an Academy member. So you're right.
These are the people who might conceivably be voting for an Oscar. Not everyone in the ACE Guild votes on the Oscars, correct, but a lot of them do. Same thing with the Art Directors, the Writers Guild, and the Producers Guild. So when we look at the ACE Award nominees, there are 5 dramas and 5 comedies. And basically, you'll find all the usual suspects, with the one wild card being Deadpool 2. What happened with the Art Directors?
Well, the Art Directors, out of their 4 main categories, they have, I guess, 15 films, period, fantasy, contemporary, animated. They kind of cover all their bases. Now, they had, of course, the usual suspects, but then they went and they got The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which was effectively a Netflix movie, Fantastic Beasts, The House with a Clock in Its Walls, Ready Player One, A Quiet Place, Mission Impossible Fallout, The Grinch, and Marwin. So that's yes, kind of, they're looking at, like, you know, what do the sets look like? What, you know, what is the production design? That's really what they're looking at.
So when you're thinking about a wild card, you could see, like, maybe they loved the Marwin set design. It will get no nomination anywhere else, but maybe it'll slip into the Art Director's nominees come Oscar time. Same thing with the Writers Guild. They always have really good taste. I love the writer nominations when you get to the Oscars. And in this nomination area, they have 10 nominees, 5 for original and 5 for adapted. And the wild cards that popped up here were Eighth Grade and A Quiet Place, which you remember was also nominated by the Art Directors Guild. So A Quiet Place, if we're looking at Best Picture nominees, it's looking like there's more and more possibility that that'll get included. The one thing that struck me in the Writers Guild was that no animated film got a writing nomination, either original or adapted. Hey, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse doesn't write itself, people.
Yeah, and that was a good movie, by the way.
It was a very good movie.
Yeah. Now, speaking of good movies, A Quiet Place, right? I mean, I'm surprised it's nominated for a writing award since effectively it was a silent movie, right? I mean, just kidding. Now, the Producers Guild also kind of mentioned A Quiet Place. They did it very quietly, though. They didn't really yell it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so the nominees from the Producers Guild, Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, Crazy Rich Asians, The Favorite, Green Book, A Quiet Place, as I just mentioned, Roma, A Star Is Born, Vice.
The Oscars would be thrilled if they had that lineup of popular films alongside a handful of indie arty fare. They would just be delighted. And so kind of just like the SAG Awards, the producers really embraced the big hits like Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther. You know, and A Star Is Born and A Quiet Place. I mean, these are big, popular movies that people know and have seen. So that's what the Oscars is looking for when they expand their categories. That's what they haven't quite gotten yet. But this year's going to be the year where it really comes home. It's pretty clear we're going to get Black Panther and A Star Is Born and A Quiet Place and Crazy Rich Asians and Bohemian Rhapsody, probably. Those are big, big movies that a lot of people have seen. Maybe that'll help boost the ratings a little bit.
Yeah, now, you know, unlike the Writers Guild, they did include some nominees for animated films. They have a whole animated category.
They have a category, yeah. So of course they do.
And Dr. Seuss's The Grinch, The Incredibles 2, Isle of Dogs, Ralph Breaks the Internet, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which I think is just going to clean up this year. I think it's just going to run the gamut.
Well, I don't think it's a given. I mean, it could be The Incredibles 2. It could be Isle of Dogs. I think those are the three contenders. I'm hoping Spider-Man pulls it out, but I still think it's the underdog. I think the ringer here was The Grinch, not The Ringer, but The Wild Card. That's the movie that sort of snuck in here, I think. We'll have to see how it does come Oscar time. But those are probably 4 of the 5 nominees you'll see. Remember, the Producers Guild has 8,200 members, and its winner does not match the Oscar necessarily. 20 out of the last 29 times, they have picked the winner that went on to win the Oscar for Best Picture. So that's 2 out of every 3 times. So it's helpful. It's indicative. But, you know, 1 out of every 3 times, it won't be the movie picked by the Producers Guild. So don't think that it's a lock-in. However, they do use preferential balloting in a very similar measure to the Oscars. And that might make them become more in sync as the years go on.
Well, you know who's not in sync with their own TV show?
Who is that?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, is it DeGrasse? I'm probably saying it like Degrassi because of the TV show. I always read it in my head as Degrassi, but I've never really heard his name said very much.
Well,
I'm sure you're right.
You probably won't be hearing it said on his chat show, Star Talk. And that brings us into our sexual misconduct segment.
That's right. You know, he's being investigated. Some multiple allegations arose. One or two were previous, and a new one has come up. So now National Geographic said, hey, the show had its season debut a few weeks ago. We've aired 3 episodes, but we're going to put it on hold while we look into all this just to show respect for the process and what we're doing. So they've put his show on hold just after 3 episodes. They paused it right in the middle, and that's happening right now. The bigger one coming up is Cosmos on Fox. That debuts in March. Maybe we'll have to see what happens there if they can finish that investigation thoroughly and properly, but without interfering with their TV scheduled, you know, programming. That gives them pressure to try to wind it up quickly, but that maybe isn't the best optic when you're trying to show you're taking this seriously.
And then over at CBS, where there was a CBS joke made on the Globes last night about Leslie Moonves. Only one joke. They had some issues in their newsroom, and now a woman will be heading it up for the first time ever.
Yes, Susan Zirinsky becomes the first female president of CBS News. No TV news division, I think, has more history or standing than CBS. If nothing else, they oversee 60 Minutes, which is an iconic show, and still can really set an agenda and create conversation. So overseeing the turmoil there alone is really important. It's important for CBS and for everyone. You know, if women aren't represented behind the scenes, then it's really hard to get change going. And we see that at the movies, yet another new survey looking at the top 250 films of the year and where women are faring. Only 8% of those top 250 films were directed by women. Only 4% had female cinematographers. One out of four movies had at least one female editor, and about one out of four movies had at least one female writer. They're doing better when it comes to producing and executive producing. About 60% of all movies had at least one female executive producer, and 75% of movies, just about, had at least one female producer. So that's, you know, not great. 8%, nowhere near the 52% it should be. 4% cinematographers, it's going to take a long time to make those numbers look better.
I thought Sandra Oh's joke about female filmmakers was very funny last night.
Get a man, that one?
Yeah, get a man. If a man's not available, get two men.
I was waiting for then, finally, after three men, get man of color. Then, if not them, maybe woman. Yeah, I like Patricia Clarkson's comment. She won an award and she said, hey, you asked me for everything except sex, which is the way it should be. I thought that was very funny.
Yeah, well, yeah, I thought that was actually, that got that got applause, actually, not a laugh, but yeah.
Yeah, that was a great comment. I mean, it was just, it's funny, but it's, of course, powerful and true. And Kim Masters has been covering stuff like this for a long time. She's a great industry reporter. She's at the Hollywood Reporter now, and she's raised questions about the TV show Smilf. That's a small comedy on Showtime created by and starring Frankie Shaw, a woman. Good for her. She got a show on the air. It got good reviews. They're about to enter season two. The problem is that numerous employees made complaints to Disney's anonymous hotline and felt like they got no response. At best, they got something saying, yeah, it's been taken care of. And they're like, well, how? What do you mean? No one spoke to me. So employees have complained. And then Rosie O'Donnell, who had a role on the show, she raised concerns about the on-set atmosphere and Shaw's treatment of others. The guilds became aware of the situation about numerous complaints. But when Hollywood Reporter went to do a story about all this, Showtime refused to comment. However, they anonymously told another outlet that they stand by Shaw 100%. You know, rather than saying what they should, which is, hey, we take these allegations seriously and we're going to look into it. They just played dumb when Hollywood Reporter came calling and then told other people, we stand behind our creator. You know, ABC says they're going to investigate, but the people complaining say they haven't been spoken to by anyone. And as Kim Masters points out, this is kind of on a small show. You know, Smilf is not a blockbuster show. You can imagine problems when you're tackling the star or creator of a big smash hit. This is Smilf. And if Showtime is slow dragging it and anonymously supporting the creator even before they've done an investigation, if big stars like Rosie O'Donnell and numerous employees can go through the proper measures and nothing seems to happen until stories are written, if all this is going on a small show, you can imagine how much harder it would be to create change on a big show, which just goes to say there's a whole lot of work to be done.
Well, while that work is being done, why don't we move on into our Big Deal or Big Whoop segment, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Ellen DeGeneres is a nice person. My kids love her.
I like her.
She's also friends with Kevin Hart. So it was no surprise when she had him on her show to talk about his anti-gay comments. It seemed like a safe place. The perfect platform to talk about the controversy over his attitudes towards gay people, make amends, and start to move forward. But instead of helping Hart, Ellen got herself into a lot of hot water. She saw the whole controversy as simply an internet attack by haters rather than people reasonably asking why a guy who has made numerous anti-gay comments has been picked to host a gay-friendly TV event like the Oscars. Hart played the victim, lied yet again about having apologized in the past. I guess he hasn't apologized. And Ellen rushed to call the Academy and urge them to allow him to host. After numerous groups weighed in, including, by the way, GLAAD and CNN anchor Don Lemon, they seem to have only made the matter worse. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? So it went on to Ellen. She sort of you know, stumbled, though she may not think she did. She sort of saw it from the viewpoint of a celeb and how other celebs are constantly attacked and mocked and belittled online. And there's always haters out there. That just was not the right way to see this issue, as if it was, you know, just mean, nasty little people who brought this up. It's like, no. He talked about beating the crap out of his kid. One interesting thing I didn't know was that GLAAD had repeatedly reached out to him. And they didn't say this publicly, you know, when they were doing, but they reached out to him, you know, when this stuff was going on and in the years since, and again, recently when it came up again and said, hey, do you want to work with us? Whatever. And he ignored them. They didn't put out a press release saying he ignored them, because that's not how they work. But, you know, by the way, when this cropped up again, when he was named the Oscar host, they didn't call on him to be fired. You know, it was not a pile. They just said, hey, use your platform to speak positively on this issue. That's what we're calling him to do. So they weren't piling on. People were just saying, really? You know, him after all the stuff he did and barely seemed to care about it? You know, I mean, to me, it's not even about him partnering with a gay group. He should just partner with a parenting group. He should be doing a PSA for a parenting group or the Black community, some group, and say, hey, you know what? Hitting your kids is wrong. Don't beat your kids for any reason. The only time you should lay your hands on your kids is when you're going to hug them. You know, he doesn't have to be saying I love gay people. At least start by saying beating your children is not a good idea, because it wasn't funny. Don Lemon on CNN urged him to step up and change. And again, not saying he shouldn't be on the Academy. He just said, hey, you know, you can be a great platform and a voice. Try and do that. So, yeah. It was a fumble by Ellen, a fumble by Kevin Hart. And I love the idea that's popped up on Reddit again and some other people have championed. I think we mentioned this too a few years ago when people were talking about it. Let the Muppets host. It's Disney. It's ABC. It's all the same company. I'd love to see Kermit host and Miss Piggy here and the old men in the balcony there grouching about how long it is. It's a no-brainer. It's probably too complicated to do it right now.
I was just going to say, you know how much work that would take?
Well, they got the puppeteers. They just got to write script. It's not that complicated. They do it every day on Sesame Street. It's just getting the talent lined up and are they available and all that, just like any other host. But they're running out of time. And you know what? Do it for next year. Plan it for next year. It's a good idea.
I think at this point there will be no host.
Right? Well, that's a disaster.
Well, record labels don't believe Spotify when it insists it has no interest at all in becoming a direct competitor. So will they believe Apple? That company has a long relationship with entrepreneur Denzel Fagelson, an early pioneer in creating platforms for artists who want to sell to fans directly. Back in the CD era, and yes, by the way, the CD era is over, unfortunately, he created a successful website that did just that. Steve Jobs spotted it, and Fagelson worked with Apple for years on launching iTunes, the iPhone, the iPad, and Apple Music. Now Apple has acquired his latest venture. It's called Platoon. It's a platform so artists can sell music directly to fans, but with a lot more features that do the job record labels used to do, things like marketing, funding, recording suites, audio editing suites, fiscal management, you name it. If you've got Platoon, what do you need a label for? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop because Apple is so big they can acquire stuff and not necessarily do anything with it. So I think they probably intend to because of their long relationship with him. And in fact, Platoon will even be doing some A&R to discover artists on their own. So maybe I think instead of a one-stop shop for people who don't want to associate with a label, you know, like Kindle is and the Amazon store for self-publishing authors, maybe it's more akin to Amazon's publishing imprint where they say we're going to be like the other labels and just do this on the side. It makes people nervous, but hey, you know, as opposed to letting every artist be their own label, in which case everybody leaves everyone, if they're just another label competing fairly and equitably with the other guys, maybe that won't freak out people so much.
Broadway hit all sorts of milestones this year, thanks to increasing attendance and increasing ticket prices, especially for long-running hits. The calendar year grossed a record $1.8 billion. Attendance was at its highest since 1984, hitting 14.4 million tickets sold. Hamilton is the first show in history to gross more than $4 million in a single week on a regular 8-performance schedule. Harry Potter has set a one-week record for any play in the history of Broadway, and To Kill a Mockingbird set a one-week record for an American play. Thank you, tourists, and thank you to the last week of the year, which is often the busiest week of the entire calendar year. We'll be talking about the individual shows with Michael in a moment, but at least right now, Michael, tell us, big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big deal, right? If you can increase prices and increase attendance, you're definitely happy if you're a Broadway producer.
That is true, because you know, usually price goes up, attendance might dip down a little bit. But I guess supply and demand is not working as one might think here, because the demand is so high.
Well, and the supply is so limited. I still think it's bad for creating future Broadway theater goers because it's so darn pricey. I wouldn't even think about buying a ticket to a show. I had a guest in town. My friend Diego is here, and he's looking at shows. Should he go see Harry Potter before the original cast leaves? I'm like, well, you got $400 you want to spend. Sure.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Well, yeah. Just look at opera. I mean, when you go to opera, you don't see the teeny boppers there. And yes, I know that that has to do with music and the type of music that it is, but it's also incredibly expensive.
Oh, yeah.
So the entertainment business is more global than ever, but each market still contains their own challenges. Economic, cultural, political, you name it. Everyone wants to make money everywhere, but sometimes that can backfire. Google gets in trouble every time it tries to launch a censored version of itself in China. Apple gets in trouble for making its phones there, since workers have far fewer rights and protections, although now there's a whole thing about Apple not making as much money in China anyway. And now Netflix is in trouble for doing business in the repressive monarchy of Saudi Arabia, a country where a young woman just made worldwide headlines for seeking asylum elsewhere, saying she'll be killed for rejecting Islam if forced back home. Netflix probably hopes their bowing to Saudi Arabia pressure is soon forgotten, although since we're mentioning it here, it probably won't be. They pulled an episode of the TV show Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj because the government told them to. Their hands are tied and they must follow local laws, claims Netflix. The offending element, what was that? Minhaj mocked Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's and that country's ever-changing explanation for the murder of a journalist and the U.S.'s long-standing relationship with the oil-rich regime. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Yeah,
you know,
I would agree.
Nobody's going to care. They'll forget about it next week. There's not going to be any pressure on them. It'll be business as usual. So, you know, it's just not going to matter. Something much bigger will have to happen than them pulling a single episode of a single show.
Happy Public Domain Day to you, Michael.
Well, happy PD Day to you too, Sperling.
Oh, I didn't know we've shortened it to PD now. It's got an acronym. Yes.
Second reference.
Yeah, okay. The beginning of every new year should include a flood of new work entering the public domain in North America. The rules vary from country to country, but there is one basic element, okay? And that's, by and large, intellectual works like books and music stay out of the public domain far longer than they should. And this benefits big corporations, not the descendants of artists so much, and certainly not the public. But on to the good news. This year, a 21-year drought has ended since the Congress, the U.S. Congress, extended copyright yet another few decades, and they did this a few decades back. Now, a flood of work enters the public domain at a rate not seen in ages. So Michael can now read the entire Robert Frost poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, on our podcast, and we won't have to pay a penny. Heck, he could riff on it in one of his freestyle raps, printed on a mug, you name it.
Like, I stopped by the woods on a snowy night. Okay, sorry, keep going.
Okay, well, like everything else, being freed from the shackles of copyright, it was first published in 1923. Among the many works entering the public domain, books by P.G. Wodehouse, Edgar Rice Burroughs of Tarzan fame, Winston Churchill, and Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, a perennial bestseller. In movies, silent films by Charlie Chaplin, Cecil B. DeMille, and the like are now free to all, including Harold Lloyd's comedy classic Safety Last and DeMille's first blockbuster adaptation of The Ten Commandments. In music, lots of classic blues and Broadway and pop are free at last, including London Calling. No, not the album by The Clash, but the musical by Noel Coward. Oh, and one more song I'm afraid to mention because I know Michael will start singing it.
What song?
It's the novelty number. Okay, I'm going to mention it, but I'm going to try and do it fast so that maybe he doesn't hear. Yes, we have no bananas.
Yes, we have no bananas. We have. Okay, you can go.
Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's great that the dam has burst. And you know what? In 2024, Mickey Mouse will be free. And as we've said, we will have champagne on the air if and when that ever happens.
Yes, I was just going to say, so a fair warning to Disney, you have 5 years to lobby to get the law changed.
And they will be.
Yes, that's why I'm kind of saying that, so that when it actually happens, we can forget that we mentioned it on this episode and just kind of say that we mentioned it on an episode, because I'll never be able to find this episode where we mentioned it before. Now, that brings us to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, speaking of things we've said on previous shows, okay, we've talked about Broadway productions that are kind of either out now or about to be out now. You know, they're on stage, so to speak. And this week, we're going to take a look at Michael's picks from the fall Broadway season and hold his feet to the fire.
Ouch.
He had to decide, should he invest or not invest in new shows? So how did he do with the fall season's picks? We've got a list of his picks, but we'll focus on, you know, on a couple shows he got really right or really, really wrong, and the ones the jury is still out on. So invest or not invest, summer and fall 2018 edition. I'll name the show and remind everyone of Michael's pick and then deliver the verdict. So let's start with Head Over Heels, the Go-Go's musical, okay? Michael said he would not invest. The verdict? Good call, actually. And I think I said the same thing. I said, yeah, it's probably a good call. I've heard it's not very good.
Yeah, it got pretty mixed reviews. Actually, though, I know some Broadway, you know, fanatics who just love it. It's a broad sort of theatrical sort of comedy, a lot of gay-friendly characters. My friend Diego just saw it and thought it was pretty good. His friend that he went with loved it, went to it for the second time. But yeah, it doesn't matter if you got a passionate little fan base when a movie doesn't run. It's closing early, too bad.
Well, maybe they had the beat.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty Woman, the musical. Michael said he would not invest. The verdict, another good call.
All right, yeah. This was a little harder because it's a big show, big name, and women dominate the audience on Broadway. But yeah, a good movie title is not nearly enough, and they didn't pull it off.
Okay, now this next one, Bernhardt / Hamlet. It's a new drama starring Janet McTeer. Michael said he would invest, which is why I lost all my money, because the verdict is it was a bad call.
Hey, it's not my fault. I think I said I really knew I shouldn't invest, but I wanted to anyway, and it was a real roll of the dice. But yeah, it certainly did not pay off. Didn't come even close. Even I didn't like it, but it happens.
The Nap is another production, the British snooker comedy, and that snooker is a game, for those of you who don't know. Michael said he would not invest, and the verdict is, since nobody knows what snooker is, a good call.
Well, you know, this is from the guy who wrote One Man, Two Governors, which was a success on Broadway and turned James Corden into an American star. So I was really looking forward to it, but it seemed like a stretch and it looked like it hadn't done great in the UK. Though those things can be a little obscure sometimes because they don't publish weekly grosses like Broadway does. But it turned out to be the safe bet, not a successful show.
Then there's a show everybody is talking about, The Ferryman. The overstuffed import about the Troubles. And the Troubles are in Ireland, of course. Michael said he would invest. And the verdict is, good call.
Yeah, though there's so many damn people on stage, I don't know if we'll make any money. Because there's like 27 people on stage. It's unbelievable how crowded. Plus a rabbit. Plus a goose. I mean, it's just, in fact, it's so crowded. The New York Times wrote a story about how difficult it is backstage just to maneuver everyone in and around each other because they're all stuffed into this tiny little space waiting for their turn to make an entrance. So that was the question I had after the show. What the hell is the backstage like? But it was a good show, probably the best Martin McDonagh has written, and a terrific cast. So I was really lucky and glad to have seen it.
Torch Song, the revival starring Michael Urie. Michael said he would not invest. The verdict? Probably a good call.
Yeah, you know, all these shows were sort of using a fantasy baseball version of investing or not investing. This is a revival, which means if you put money into this revival, you're not going to make money from any future revivals. It's just going to be this one run. So Michael Urie is a pro. It got good reviews off Broadway. I didn't think it was the right call to move it to Broadway, and it has closed a little bit early, and he's bummed because they got, you know, again, friendly reviews. But he's going to tour with it, and, you know, he could pull this into the black after touring because he's a well-known person. He's been on hit TV shows, so he could pull it out for the investors, but it's clearly not going to be a big success, and the most they can hope for is to eke out a, no win, no loss.
King Kong the Musical. Yeah, never thought I'd be saying those words together. Michael said he would not invest, as did I. The verdict? Of course it's a good call.
Well, I don't know about of course. It's still doing well. If you look at the box office, it's grossing over $1 million, especially around the holidays. It may run a year and a half. It may run 2 years, but it was so expensive, like Spider-Man, and the weekly running costs are so expensive, they're not going to make much of their money back, and I don't think this is somehow going to turn into magical money on the road. It's not going to work.
You know, paying that big giant ape, it's really hard.
So many bananas.
Yeah, and we have no bananas. Although we can actually afford to sing the song. Okay, well, The Prom, okay, is another production. Michael said he would invest. And this is why my kids will not be going to college. Thank you very much, Michael. The verdict is it's probably a bad call.
Well, why do you only invest in things that I end up messing up on? I don't understand that. But anyway, The Prom is a musical about Broadway stars who need to improve their Q ratings, make people like them again. So they descend on a small town to support a young teenage lesbian who just wants to go to the prom with her girlfriend. She doesn't want their help. Nobody wants them around, but they're Broadway stars. They want the spotlight. It was light. It was silly. I like some of the people in it. I didn't like the show. It got some pretty good reviews out of town, but this one did not pull it off.
The Cher Show. And by Cher, I don't mean like as in, you know, everybody should share. I mean, Cher is in the person, the singer, the movie, the Oscar winner. Michael said he would not invest. The verdict: good call?
Probably it's still, you know, still a little bit up in the air, and we don't know their financials, but it's an expensive show to run. It's complicated because you need 3 shares to do on the road. Maybe it'll tour for years. It's certainly not going to be one that has a big second life in high school and community theater productions, unless you got some woman in your community and you go, wow, that's Cher. I don't see it being a big hit in that way, but you never know. So maybe really long term, this will be okay. It's such an iconic brand name, but I don't think it's going to end its Broadway run in triumph.
To Kill a Mockingbird. I love that book. It's a great book. And I think Michael said he would not invest in the book. Oh, wait, no, it's the show. I guess it's a play now. And he said he would not invest in that. And the verdict there is it's a good call.
Yeah, you know, this was weird and complicated. I felt like it's a limited run with Jeff Daniels. I don't know how it's going to work with other people. I knew it was a no-brainer in terms, but what I had said was, Scott Rudin's involved. I'm never going to get a good deal with this show. They're never going to let me have any money. Don't invest with Scott Rudin. I'm never going to see a penny. I'll get the worst terms on Broadway. So yeah, it'll be a big hit. And I'm a penny-ante investor. I'm not going to see much of any of it. So, you know, why bother? Do it on a show where you don't have a big name involved and a big star and a big property where your little pennies that are tossed into the plate aren't going to make a difference. Do it with a show like The Ferryman or something else where you feel like you've got a winner and you feel like you can help it and they need you more. So when you're investing on Broadway, find the show that needs you the most and that you're going to be happy to have put money into, even if it flops. Because when you're investing on Broadway, the only reason to do it is love.
Yeah, you know, the way Scott Rudin divvies up the kitty there, it's heads I win, tails you lose.
Yeah, I'm sure he's not doing anything illegal. It's just you're not going to good terms because he doesn't need you. He's got everyone in the world throwing money at him. And in fact, when he does shows now, he sort of parcels it out. He says, hey, you want to invest in this big show? You got to invest in 2 others that you're less excited by. It's that old Disney thing that they did where they said, here, invest in our slate of films.
Slate financing is exactly what they call that. Yeah.
So have you been in London? Have you been to the London and seen theater there?
You know, I've seen opera there. I've seen some theater there. But I have to say, what I really don't recall is spending a lot of time in line for the bathroom.
Well, you should, because in London, it's just like New York. A lot of the theaters are old, and they have very minimal accommodations for the bathroom. And that's even worse for the women, because, of course, you've got a lot of stalls. Men have urinals that can be squeezed in a little bit better. And there's fewer men. Most theatergoers are women. So there's more women than men. Fewer locations for them to use the loo, and therefore it just becomes a huge, huge problem. But London, just like Broadway, is finally tackling it. A number of spaces are being renovated to make the stalls for women actually, you know, accommodating to at least a better degree. And when we say stalls, we should say loo, because stalls are actually some of the things they call in the orchestra section of the show.
That's
on Broadway, we call it the orchestra, and in London, they call it the stalls. They're not going to the bathroom in the middle of the theater. That's not happening. They're going to the back where the loo is. So anyway, yeah, just like Broadway, they're finally doing something about it. It's not going to make it great, but it will at least make it bearable.
Well, in the time that we mentioned Scott Rudin not sharing any profits, Actors Equity decided that they were going to go on strike specifically over that.
No, not on that at all, whatsoever.
What? This is not about. It says actors' equity, considering the limited strike over profit sharing. Right there, right there.
Yes, but it's nothing to do with, nothing to do with producers.
No, I know, but it was a nice segue. Now you killed it.
I'm sorry. So yeah, what happened is Actors Equity has noticed that over the last five seasons, a lot more shows are using what's called a developmental lab. It's 4 weeks or longer in which everyone gets together and is paid to work on a show. And they're saying, hey, if we're contributing to the creation of a show, we want a little piece of it. Not a lot. They just say, hey, you know what? First of all, we started these development lab contracts like a decade ago, and we haven't gotten a raise, so we want a little bit more money from the $1,000 a week we get paid. But when the show goes on and becomes a hit and recoups its investment, after that, the actors who participate, we want to share 1% of any profits. That's what they're asking for. So they have been negotiating on this for several years. Equity says, you know what? We're at an impasse. We've been doing this for years. And the Broadway League says, it's fine. Let's just keep talking. What's the problem? Everything's going great. So as many years as they can get without actually making a deal and not having to strike, they're happy. A lot of big productions do this. A Chorus Line to Hamilton, they've had developmental labs. And in fact, the cast of Hamilton rose up and said, you know what? We really like a piece of this show. And Lin-Manuel Miranda backed them up. And the producers, realizing they had the once-in-a-lifetime show and didn't need any bad press, realized they should do it. But that's rare. You've got such a talented cast and such a monster hit and such a spotlight that they can actually have some leverage. They need it in their contract. Equity says one out of every four new shows on Broadway does this. The number doing it has doubled in the last 5 years. They've done it, developmental labs, for shows like The Cher Show, To Kill a Mockingbird, Waitress, Frozen, Mean Girls, even Hello Dolly, which kind of shocks me because it's a revival.
Yeah, why do you need a that's true.
I can't even imagine why they did it, but you know what? They needed to work things out. And in that case, they might have said, let's skip a developmental lab because they won't have to fork over some money to all the actors involved. But whatever the reason is, they're finding developmental labs more and more useful. And this is all happening in the shadow of upcoming negotiations, broader negotiations between Actors Equity and the Broadway League. So everybody would like to get this out of the way, but Equity's not budging.
Well, you know, I remember first hearing about developmental labs with Rent. That was the first big show where, you know, it was kind of that workshopped forever. Although
they've done it throughout for decades. It's not new.
But I personally, what I'm saying. And certainly Jonathan Larson gets the credit for, you know, writing the book and the music and all of that. But
The dramaturgs sued as well for feeling they did not get their fair portion of their contribution to the show.
That's where I was headed with that, is that, you know, there's all of these little things that occur in a workshop that help lend to the show. Certainly it happened in Hamilton, as you saw it both on Broadway and beforehand. And it happened on Rent, because I saw it both on Broadway and beforehand.
Well, the developmental lab happened before the off-Broadway event that I saw. You know, that happened before you saw Rent in that little space. The developmental lab was before that.
Okay.
Yeah. That takes place before. It's like, in fact, at the end of a developmental lab, they will often do a performance of one or both acts, if it's a two-act show, for investors to see if they want to invest in it. So this is very early in the process. Every show is different. They might go on the road and then do a developmental lab because they feel like it's not done. But usually this is towards the beginning of the creative process, not after you've done an off-Broadway run and are moving it to Broadway. That's not when you do a developmental lab. So it's different for every show. It's complicated. It happens a lot. It's happening more. And Actors Equity is saying, we want a piece of that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether they get it or not.
That's right. And one thing nobody will get is eternal life. It just doesn't happen here on Earth. And so we get to the obituary section where we're going to talk about three different people. A lot of fascinating, important people died. These are three. We have something maybe a little worthwhile to talk about. Disney animator Don Lusk died at 105. The captain of the musical duo Captain and Tennille died. And Richard Marx, the four-time Oscar nominee for editing, died at 75.
I was wondering why everybody was talking about Captain and Tennille last week.
Love will keep us together. I remember their show, and interestingly, they say the show was a hit, but they just didn't want to do it. The captain in particular really did not like being on the air.
Well, okay. Who do you want to talk about? Don Lusk. I mean, he was 105 years old, so he worked on a lot of Disney films. Bambi, Fantasia, Pinocchio. I guess he drew the mice in Cinderella. He did Alice Falling Down the Hole in Alice in Wonderland. He did some Charlie Brown movies and 136 episodes of Smurfs he directed.
God help him. And he's fascinating and an important person in Disney animation. He's gotten a Lifetime Achievement Award from some of the big animation award shows. But what I found interesting when I was reading about his life was two things. One, Frank and Ollie, two of the animators that even casual fans might have heard of because a documentary was made about them, they praised his work. They said the scenes of the glowing white fish and the Arabian dance section of Nutcracker Suite, that's in Fantasia, amazed the whole studio. Never has an object on celluloid looked so diaphanous and delicate. No one had ever seen such a gossamer effect, and very few knew how it had been achieved. And that was Don Lusk's work. And he, along with a lot of people, went on strike. This is in the 40s. He went on strike with hundreds of others looking for a raise from $87.50 a week. It lasted 5 weeks, and while it was going on, he worked at a liquor store. And lovable Uncle Walt never forgot. All those people who participated were slowly blackballed and given more and more menial work and credit if they were held on to. And Lusk's last work at Disney included some of the dogs and 101 Dalmatians. And by that point, he says his name was practically the last one listed in the credits. So lovable Uncle Walt did not like unions.
No, not at all. Still doesn't, in fact.
Nope.
Okay, so we talked about the captain, Daryl Dragon from Captain and Tennille.
That's right. He died at 76.
And Richard Marks, a four-time Oscar nominee for editing, he died at 75.
Yeah, a great career. I mean, this is, you know, he was an Oscar nominee for Apocalypse Now, Terms of Endearment, Broadcast News, and As Good as It Gets, which is pretty good credits just for Oscar nominations. He worked on every film of James L. Brooks.
Yeah, well, and he, think about it this way. He worked for Francis Ford Coppola on Apocalypse Now for 3 years, most of the time in the Philippines.
Yes, that's amazing. And the films he was, I don't know why The Godfather Part II wasn't nominated for an Oscar. That whole back and forth between the period and the present should have gotten that movie attention. And of course, it won tons of Oscars, but somehow it was overlooked for film editing. He also did Heart of Darkness, about the making of Apocalypse Now. He edited that. And then a lot of great movies, Bang the Drum Slowly, Serpico, Say Anything, hits like Father of the Bride, You've Got Mail, St. Elmo's Fire, Pretty in Pink, a cult favorite of mine, Buckaroo Banzai, and his last hit film, Julie and Julia, with Meryl Streep. And you know, talking about people mentoring other people, he was mentored by the great Dee Dee Allen, a female film editor. They co-edited Serpico, and she was such a great influence on him and other film editors that he said he wanted to pay that forward. He taught film editing at UCLA. He said, quote, Dee Dee loved to talk to her assistants as she worked to explain and to teach and to include them in the process. And because of her, that's why he went on to teach and try and mentor as many other people as he could.
You know, I wonder now, it used to be that, you know, film editing was a very slow process. You know, you had to, you know, these clips and trims of different shots, and it was all very physical. Now mm-hmm. It's all virtual. It's all digital. So, there, you know, in other words, film editing, when Dee Dee was working with Richard Marks, I mean, you could take some time to teach and talk, whereas now it's, you know, clickety-clackety, and you're pretty much just with the keyboard. And you can do things in minutes that used to take hours.
That's true.
So I wonder if there's still that liberty of talking and teaching while you're editing.
Oh, absolutely. Because you're looking at, my friend taught me as he was doing editing on his film, his student film or, you know, graduate thesis film. And, you know, it's online and digital and all that. And it's quick to be able to compile different versions and all that. And he was showing me, here's this, here's with two screens taking out, here's what we're doing there. So no, absolutely. There's no loss in the ability to mentor and teach other people. But before we get to the end of the show, I should mention the cinematographers have weighed in and they have named their nominees for best shot film of the year.
Roma.
Roma is in there. Absolutely. So is A Star Is Born, The Favorite, First Man, and Cold War. That's a great ringer, a black and white Polish film that's up for best foreign film, isn't it? Or have they announced the shortlist yet? No, they haven't. But that's a likely nominee to make it into the final five of the best international films of the year. And they also have a thing where they spotlight festival movies or movies just in limited release. And that's another beautifully shot film. It's The Rider. That a lot of people have that on their best of the year list. And a big reason is the cinematography of Joshua James Richards. So don't be surprised if he sneaks onto the Oscar list as well.
Well, and you know who shot Roma?
Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't just the director. He shot it, too.
He edited it as well, didn't he?
I think he, yeah, well, yes,
wait,
he did.
Well, I mean, his, yeah,
he,
okay.
He cast it.
He wrote it.
He acted in it. No, okay, I'm kidding. But that does conclude our show for this week, and we'd like to remind you, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review our show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find the show as well. So please do subscribe to the show in any one of those places. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle on Twitter, or facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can also email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information, once again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz every week has a website that's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Let Carol Burnett Host the Oscars.
Actually, that would be a good idea.
I think she's up for it.
Yes, I agree with you. I did like Dick Van Dyke's joke when he said, I saw Carol Burnett and I went, oh, I recognize her. I guess that was a joke about his own age.
That's very cute.
But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work appears. And don't forget to check out bookfilter.com, where, you know, you can find out what you should be reading. Some of my work appears on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Stopping by Woods on a Wintry Evening by Robert Frost. Whose woods these are, I think I know.
Oh, my God.
His house is in the village, though.
Are you going to do the whole thing?
They will not see me seeing there to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse.
I got to go. There's
to
a...
stop without a farmhouse.
See you later, Michael.
The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep.